Ken Burns joins us right now. He really needs no introduction. First of all, how are you getting along? You live not in a major city. You live in a kind of a rural community, right?
I do. I live in a tiny little village in New Hampshire and I have for the last 40-plus years and raised my two first girls there, and they're out and up and kids of their own, and I've got two little girls now very much at home trying to explain to them why, you know, they can't go out and other than to take walks and play or see friends. It's tough, but we're doing okay, and I hope you are and your family are safe as well.
Thank you. Little kids, that's true. It's very hard to explain to them why they have to be confined and understand the real dangers here. How are you communicating that?
Well, you know, for a while there was the kind of defiance from the 15-year-old that she was going to go play with her friends because last week a couple of her friends got together. And I said, I'm sorry, you're not going to do that. And then she said, she threw a kind of tantrum, and I finally broke down and used, you know, the tool I have, which is terrifying information, and described the terrible story of the family in New Jersey that had gone to a party and now four people were dead and seven were in critical condition. I said, I'm sorry, I'm not about those odds with you, you know, and she got it.
Yeah.
And all she's doing is sleeping late.
That's, I think, what teenagers do. 1918, let's go back to that, the pandemic of 1918. Your thoughts on how these two events equate?
Well, you know, I think we've got to be better this time around. And I say that only because David Brooks wrote an amazing piece a few weeks ago in the New York Times, an editorial, talking about the fact that it doesn't show up on our radar that much, even though there was a tremendously high death toll. Many more people died of the Spanish flu than they did in World War I, at least in the American side. But it was one of these pandemics for which there was no remediation. The economies didn't stop. But a lot of people died, and a lot of people were left for dead. And I think there was a sense of disconnect of the thing that binds us together, which is the thing I'm insistent on us not losing. The thing that why we Americans agree to cohere is not because of a particular race or a particular ethnicity or a particular religion, but because we subscribe to one sentence published on July 4, 1776, the second sentence of the Declaration, that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Self-evident. You know, that's it. And so we are in this together. Another way to say it, my friend, is that I've been making films about the U.S. for more than 40 years. And I also make films about us. That is to say, the lowercase two-letter plural pronoun that goes along with the capitalized U.S. And the thing that I've learned, if I've learned anything over those years, is it's just us. There's no them. And anytime anyone out there tells you there's a them, walk away. Walk away quickly, because it's the recipe for the kind of division that we are experiencing today. We need to be having everybody's oars in the water pulling in the same direction. So this has a lot of similarities. It's going to be really tough and a lot worse before it gets better. But the thing that's going to keep us together is understanding that we've got to take care of ourselves and our families.
You know what this goes to? Is this goes to one of my favorite moments in your World War II series. The months and the days leading up to December 7th, 1941, the country was fairly divided. And actually, on the morning of December 7th, 1941, there was an America First rally. Believe it or not, that was a term that was used back then as well, here in Chicago at the International Amphitheater. And it was interrupted by the news of Pearl Harbor. We were at great division, and then literally within minutes, the nation unified.
Yes, this is what has to happen now. The problem is that was a kind of obvious enemy, as was 9/11, sort of shadowy as those forces that destroyed our post-Cold War calm. Now we have a very different kind of enemy, and it attacks from within, and yet we have to mobilize in the same spirit as Pearl Harbor engendered and as 9/11 engendered, and not waste it as we did with 9/11. We were ready, everyone, Democrat, Republican, Independent, to follow our president's lead and say, we will do whatever you say. You want us to set a thermostat lower, you want us to take a 50-cent a gallon gas hike to eliminate our dependence on foreign oil, you want us to do this, we'll do this, we'll do that. And we were not marshaled. Just as right now, the signals are so completely mixed we just feel like we're being tugged in different directions. And I think it proves one of the great things about leadership. Leadership is honest, it's consistent, and it's pretty tough. It says, as Franklin Roosevelt said, there will be darker days ahead, worse than this, but we will get through it. And the same with Winston Churchill on the other side of the Atlantic. Leadership is not like tacking with the wind. Leadership is standing up in a strong gale and saying, here, draft behind me. I'll protect you, and this is what we need to do. Who's coming with me? Just about everybody after December 7th and just about everybody after September 11th said, we'll come. We'll do whatever you say. It just depends on leadership and how they mobilize. That's the critical thing.
I would add to that that leadership also has to be selfless, not interested in its own desires, needs, ego, but
I think it is that is exactly the definition of leadership, is that it understands that there is something bigger than oneself and that somebody has to be at the forward position on that. And maybe it's a grunt in Vietnam saying, let's go up this hill. Come on, follow me. Or maybe it's somebody who said, look, it's going to be tough and getting tougher, but this is what we have to do.
We're talking to Ken Burns, the greatest documentary filmmaker America has ever produced, Don't Blush, maker of The Civil War, Baseball, The War about World War II, Vietnam, Jazz, Prohibition, you name it. If it happened in the last 150 years, Ken's done a documentary about it. But now we're faced with a completely new American crisis. And even though a lot of your documentaries have been incredibly inspiring to people about getting through tough times, what do you think we can do now to get through this tough time?
There are lots of things we can do staying in our homes. Buy gift certificates from your favorite vendors. You're not going to be able to get a haircut. You're going to start looking like me pretty soon, you know?
I already do. Ken, I just want to say, I was looking in the mirror today, and I'm like, I didn't get a haircut a couple of weeks ago, and I thought, oh, man, I should have probably done that now that I'm socially isolated. And I'm looking at my razors, and I'm looking at, like, how do I give myself a haircut? I have no idea. Yeah. Let's talk about that part of it. The social contract is changing now between people.
Do you
think the handshake is going to go totally away?
I don't think it'll go totally away, but it's going to be a while before we feel comfortable extending that hand. But we can extend our hand in so many different ways. Everybody's out shopping and stocking up on too much stuff. Get some and leave some off at the food pantry. You know, drop off stuff at the Salvation Army. There are going to be people who are going to really suffer from this. We've got, right now, most of us, just tremendous anxiety and inconvenience. But for a lot of people, this is an entire job. Gone, poof, done. And they were living paycheck to paycheck. We need to just be for each other. That's the most important thing. And also, as we incubate a home, we can incubate a lot of really positive things. It's really obvious, the negative stuff that gets incubated, you know, getting cabin fever, getting stir crazy, want to go out, do the usual stuff. And a lot of anxiety exists from there. But there are ways in which we can come together. You know, when the baseball season was canceled, along with all the other sports, I just turned to PBS. I said, let's just start streaming for free the baseball series from 94. People don't have anything to support. Let's just do it. Here it is. And it was a huge, big thing. And it prompted PBS to then decide to preempt Thursday night. This Thursday is the first one with a Ken Burns History Night. We're going to start with the Roosevelts, which is a perfect idea of two great crises, the Depression and World War II, and how shared sacrifice and extraordinary leadership got us through, not to mention the presidency of Theodore Roosevelt, which is nothing to laugh at either, nor the human rights courage of Eleanor after the Second World War. It's a good thing to start with. And then maybe let's take a rest, celebrate the national parks, go back to World War II, our series, The War from 2007. It will be summer by then, and it will be the 75th anniversary of the ending of the greatest cataclysm in human history. And that's a good thing to remind people of what we did, how we mobilized, that there was not anybody on any block that was unaffected by that conflagration, how we work together and do things. You and I have said this many times, too much pluribus, not enough unum.
Yeah.
We're in the business of unum. And so we've been working with PBS, children's education stuff. They've got inside of it a thing called the Ken Burns Classroom, in which we've got lots of films and lots of lesson plans and lots of ideas for teachers that can be accessed through schools or at home. We've also got an app called Unum, which is attached to the PBS website, which is curating the evergreen themes that appear and reappear in all of our films. So it might be freedom, it might be race, it might be hard times, it might be politics, it might be war, it might be leadership. Franklin Roosevelt turned to the leaders of industry, aviation, who turned out something like 4,800 planes that year, and he said, next year I need 50,000. And they said, we can't do that, Mr. President. He said, I want 50,000. Guess what? They did 50,000. So why can't we say, I need 55 million tests. I need this many surgical gloves that will never run out. I need a gallon of Purell in everyone's home. Not a chicken in every pot, but a gallon of Purell in everyone's home. I need you to make these surgical masks. I know you only turn out 40 ventilators a month. I need you to turn out 40,000 a month. So we know how to do this.
That's an excellent point. Let's go back to baseball. You mentioned it. Baseball now, the season probably at least going to be cut in half, if not completely lost. Since the scandal emerged in the last number of months, the Houston Astros cheating, will that be lost in all of this, forgotten in all of this? Because
it won't be forgotten, but it'll be lost in a significant way. The Astros must be exhaling a little bit. Let's remember that Bobby Thompson knew exactly what kind of pitch Ralph Branca was going to show him because the Giants were stealing signs and sending in the same kind of crude garbage can banging way the pitch. And the famous, the Giants win the pennant. The Giants win the pennant against Brooklyn in that three-game playoff was fraudulent. Right. And there's no asterisk against that. If you go back and you just look up, if I asked you to look up who won the 1919 World Series, it will say the Cincinnati Red Stockings. But my friend, I've got a story to tell you, right, about gangsters and about the Chicago White Stockings and about unbelievable story of what went on. Great pitchers, great players, Shoeless Joe Jackson, and great pitchers and great infielders and great outfielders. It's a sad, sad tale. But it's funny, in a sport where statistics matter, and quick, tell me how many passing yards Drew Brees has. He leads.
I don't know.
Yeah. No, you don't know. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You just know he leads if you know that. But you know how many home runs Hank Aaron's hit. You know how many home runs Babe Ruth has hit. You know what Ted Williams batted in 1941. You know how many consecutive games Joe DiMaggio that same year hit in. We know that a 300 hitter means the same thing to your kids and my kids as it does to you and me, as it did to my grandfather and my great-great-grandfather who fought in the Civil War. So this is a sport where statistics really actually do matter, but they also require a story to be told.
So how many yards does Drew Brees have?
Beats me. It's 70, I don't know, 73. There's somebody out there who knows it, but they're like an NFL fanatic. But the casual fan knows 755 and 714 and 406 and 56 straight games. If you want to hit 400, you're competing with some guy who last did that in 1941, right? Which is soon to be 80 years ago, right?
Yeah.
It's just incredible. Or 56 straight games, same thing, soon to be 80 years ago. So ironic, because you know that when the series came out in 94, everybody was saying, oh, this is really good, but nobody's going to watch it because it's coming out in September in the middle of heating up pennant races. And then, of course, baseball went on strike, and we were the only baseball around.
That's true. In the middle of the winter is the best time to watch it because it reminds you of spring. It gets you through, and you can spend 400 hours or however long it is, and you're done. You're ready for spring by the time you're done with it.
If I'm out in the world or even getting mail, it's a rare week that doesn't go by where somebody doesn't say, my dad and I watch, my son and I, every January. They'll come up and they say, we probably watched this series more than you've watched it. And they've watched it every single January since it was. And MLB Network has it in the off season, and they play it and play it. And I get letters all the time about it. Or I meet somebody the other day before all this stuff happened, and I said, I lost my dad last winter, and it means this winter we haven't been able to watch, as we always did, your series on baseball. It's not me. It's just the connection that we have. It adds that extra dimension of the thing that I'm trying to talk about, the us. You know them. It's just us. It's shared human experience. And we're really good at it, at this country, if we let it. We've permitted people to make an almighty dollar on division, and they've done really well for the last 50 years. You know, they know how to hit the right button to make you angry at this person. If only this person disappeared, that you could turn people who are just a couple degrees off azimuth from you politically into somebody as bad as the worst terrorist who's ever, you know, plotted against us from foreign shores. That sells in the short run, and it murders in the long run.
Premiering on PBS this week, Eastlake Meadows, a public housing story, and that's based on Eastlake Meadows housing project in Atlanta, right?
Right, and it's sort of the easiest shorthand is to say it's Atlanta's Cabrini Green. It's a different sort of setup. It's not high rises, but it was a place where African Americans in substandard housing were warehoused, not permitted through redlining to go out and live the American dream by going out into the suburbs and finding a place and enjoying a mortgage credit that would permit them to do something like that. But it is just an amazing story. My daughter, Sarah Burns, and her husband, David McMahon, made the film. I've been the executive producer on it, and it's a terrific story, and it's actually very pertinent how we take care of each other, whether we're going to finally judge people on the content of their character, as Dr. King said, or just on the color of their skin.
Eastlake Meadows on PBS starting this week. Ken Burns, it's always a pleasure talking to you. We could do this for hours on hours.
We really could, my friend. We really could. Please be safe.
You too.